Welcome, everybody, to the NFL Legends Show on the Grilling Truth Sports Network. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster. Before we get to our interview today, make sure you check out BetMGM, the best sports book for betting on the Super Bowl. Make sure you click on the link in the description down below if you're watching on YouTube. And today we have a legend with the Ohio State Buckeyes, that an NFL legend with the Cincinnati Bengals. 1981, made the Pro Bowl, helped the Bengals go to the Super Bowl. And at Ohio State, maybe the most underrated running back in college football history. I think you still hold the record, Pete, 25 touchdowns in a season. And that was the same season Archie Griffin's winning his second Heisman. Help me welcome to the show, Pete Johnson. How you doing, Pete?
Good, buddy. Why did everyone always want to take some of my touchdowns away? You
Is
go to
26?
NCAA 27.
27? Because I'll tell you, I looked up
my career.
I look like four different things. I got three different numbers. I don't know. Any of those numbers sound pretty high, though, Pete.
Oh, no, I can tell you a funny story. Mike Wiley, that played for the Ohio State and Cowboys, and we were going to this on this trip to an autograph session, and he bragging about his touchdown, so I didn't say a word. And he keep going. Then he looked over at me. He said, "How many do you have at Ohio State?" I said, 59. He said, "Get out of here, and I'm talking trash."
Well, yeah, them youngins don't know better sometimes. All right, so we talked about Ohio State, and I know a little bit about your journey. You ended up moving, what, to New York your senior year?
Went to New York, yep.
Yeah, so how did you end up at Ohio State?
Woody. Well, a guy by the name of Chuck Clausen recruited me. And just a super guy. But I had over 200 scholarship offered in football and 38 in basketball. But Chuck and I just hit it off, really. But I ended up signing to go to the University of West Virginia. And I finally had the nerve to tell Coach Clausen that I wasn't going to Ohio State. He said, "Well, you owe it to yourself to talk to the old man first." He said, "He's going to be in town Monday." So Monday, Coach Hayes came to town. He came over to the school. They called me down to the office, and I go to the office, and he looked at me. He said, "Well, son, you need to get back to class. But what time you get out of school?" So Coach, "Get out at 3. He said, "Well, I'll see you at your house at 4 o'clock. So I get home, and I walked in, and I don't hear him. I hear talking in the kitchen. He's in the kitchen helping my mom wash dishes.
And he won right then. He was winning mom over.
Oh, you know it. He didn't tell me I can go sit down. He'll be with me shortly. I'm about ready to kick his butt because I thought he was hitting on my mom.
That is making you look bad because you weren't the one helping her do the dishes, Pete.
How was in school?
I don't know. But so you get to go play for Woody Hayes, and that's a loaded team. You got Archie Griffin in the backfield with you. Cornelius Green was the quarterback, great all-purpose quarterback. 1975, your best game against North Carolina, probably 148 yards, correct?
Five touchdowns.
Yeah, that's not a bad season.
Oh, no.
No, and you played UCLA, though, in the regular season and beat them out there 41-20. And then you go to the Rose Bowl to take on Dick Vermeil in UCLA. You win the game, you're national champions. You end up losing the game 23-10. They had John Shira, I think, at quarterback. I think Randy Cross played on the O-line. I've interviewed him a few times, friends with him. He's a really good dude. But what do you remember about that Rose Bowl? Was that something where maybe you guys took UCLA a little lightly because you beat
No, it wasn't that at all. And we lost the second USC game because of the same thing. Coach Hay loved his players. He loved all of them. And he would do, if the media say you can't pass, he's going to prove that this guy can pass. You know me, and I think a lot of coaches, I think that's just their MO. They get in these big games, and they want to change things. You know, you can remember even though we went to UCLA, we played the Rose Bowl, and we were still, you know, winning the battle, and all of a sudden we start passing every play.
Yeah.
Instead of running the ball like what got us there. You know, but he wanted – everyone's saying Cornelius Green couldn't throw the ball and couldn't this, so Woody wanted to prove they could. You know, and then the second USC game, we beat them the first game in the Rose Bowl. The second Rose Bowl, Archer averaging about 6 or 7 yards a carry. I'm averaging 4.8. And all of a sudden, you know, would it take me out and put Champ Hinson in because he needed to get filmed on Champ, you know, for the pros?
Yeah.
We end up losing by a couple of, you know, points. Well, I think sometimes coaches, you know, they care that much, and we were the family. And we were the team, and sometimes, you know, they get a little old and senile too.
Yeah, that'll you know, happen. It happens to all of us.
Winning. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, that's what happened.
So, Coach Hayes sounds like he was a great coach to play for.
Oh, awesome.
And the thing I get is this. I got a lot of buddies that played at IU for Bobby Knight, and they all love him. And on the outside looking in, when you look at Woody Hayes, everybody wants to say, well, he was a maniac. But that's really not the case.
No. Oh, no. One of the greatest men ever lived. He loved this country. He loved the university. He loved this player. And he was a man that he gave respect. He demanded respect. And he protected his player. That's why the media didn't like it. You know, he wasn't going to let the media mess up with players and talk bad about him. And I remember he used to always say he wouldn't play Cincinnati or any of those small schools. Because if you beat them, you should have beat them. But it's a close game, your team is bad. So that's
why it's almost like you lost if you get a close game against the Cincinnati Bearcats in the 70s.
Yeah. But, you know, time changed, and Archie was the first guy to really start giving the small school a chance to make money playing Ohio State.
Yeah. And Archie Griffin, what was it like being in the backfield of Archie? You guys were maybe the most dominant college football tandem in the backfield that anybody's ever seen.
Oh, I think probably you'll never find a better backfield than we had. Brian Bashnagel, the wing back, Kaneers Green, the quarterback, Archer, tailback, I was the fullback. If people don't realize, we very seldom played past halftime. You know, it's our second and third stringer that ran the score up on people. No, once Archer got 100 yards, Woody was taking him and I out.
Yeah.
And way too much longer, you're going to take Corny and everyone out.
So let's look at it this way. Archie Griffin gets drafted by the Cincinnati Bengals. I think it was in the second round, 1976. Headed into the 1970s. Was it first round? Okay. You were saying, okay, I got him back. Well, see, I'm on your side, Pete. I wanted you to go first. But was there any thought, or did you have any inclination from the Brown family to Cincinnati Bengals that there was a chance they were going to draft you and put you with Archie again?
No. Believe it or not, I was on the phone with the Dallas Cowboys during that draft day. Yeah. And I just knew that's where I was going. And at the last minute, they did a deal with Tampa Bay and took the first round draft pick, and then they took Tony Dorsett. Yeah. And then they said, well, don't worry, we're going to get you and we'll get you the same amount of money. But then the Bengals beat them to it.
So were you happy to go to the Bengals? Because I know I've talked to a lot of guys in the 70s that, you know, the last team they wanted to be drafted by was the team Paul Brown had, Mike Brown, just because of contract situations. Mm-hmm. But were you happy to go to Cincinnati and team back up with Archie?
I wasn't one of those guys. I was those kind of guy. You say, I go there, I can make money. I know I'm going to be the best player there, so I'm going to make money if you give me the opportunity. And if you're looking for a great player, I'm the guy that's going to play. You know, so I don't even think about stuff like that. I could have went to I could have went to your team, and you made them in pro ball, and I was going to be good.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way I think. I don't care what team it is. In the NFL, you know, back then, it's the biggest mafia that was. You had no choice.
It still is the biggest mafia there is. It's still the biggest mafia there is.
Think to us old guy going on strike and fighting for free agency, they make a whole lot more money.
Yeah.
We all had to have extra jobs.
Yeah, they need to kick a little bit to the older players, too. Let's do this. There's no ESPN, no NFL Network in 1977. How did you find out that you were drafted by the Bengals?
John Johnson called and told me this one guy, he was a grad assistant for Ohio State. Him and Pete Brown was good friends. He said, hey, the Bingham's are trying to call you. He said, answer your phone. You know, back then, shit, we had a, my phone was from Central Mobile. You know, I had to call the operator to make a phone call.
Yeah.
I'm not, that telephone I had in my car, and then I wasn't home, so I couldn't answer that one. And I called, you know, called off, and they told me they had drafted me and da-da-da, and we made arrangement to meet.
Yeah, and what was, I mean, the thing is, you've been with some legends. Woody Hayes, you know, Paul Brown, Forrest Gregg, one of the greatest offensive linemen that ever lived. But what was Paul Brown like to work with? Because well, I've heard good and I've heard bad. So,
well, the whole thing is, when you own the team, people can't tell you how to run your business. You know what I mean? But the fortunate thing, when I first got there, I remember Paul Brown had retired.
Yeah. So you had Bill Tiger Johnson was the head coach.
Yeah, Tiger Johnson, which was, oh, God bless the dead. But I
could have had Bill Walsh, man. We could have had Bill Walsh.
Hey, Forrest was awesome. I put Forrest up with Woody category.
Yeah.
Just two great men, you know, and they were player coaches.
Yeah, and I think that the term player coach is kind of misunderstood a lot of times. To me, a player's coach is a coach that if I'm playing for him, I know that he cares about me. He cares
and
about my well-being.
He got you back.
A player's coach is not somebody that's just going to go let the player do what he wants.
Oh, no.
He's more like a father where he's going to expect a lot from you. And that's what makes great coaches, because really as a coach, you get what you allow to happen. And to me, if you look at the Bengals, 75-76, I mean, if you're in Cincinnati with the Bengals in 75, that might have been a Super Bowl team, because that team was 11-3. They lost a three-point game to the Raiders, and their issue was they didn't really have a running game. They get you in there in 1977, you got a running game. We finally beat the Steelers towards the end of the season, but then we lose to the Oilers, which kind of kicked that out. And then you got Homer Rice in 1978
and
79.
Oh, my goodness.
Tell me about Homer Rice.
A great, great philosopher. Great, great person. Great, great man. We went to Buffalo, and we lost... 52-2 or something like that.
I remember that game, actually. I remember watching that game. I think it was 1978.
And Homer said to us, men, that's okay. There's something positive in this. And I saw Paul Brown grab his hat off his head and crunches it and walked out and, oh, we have a new coach Monday and we have four.
Well, and the thing is, Homer Rice, if you look at his history, was a great college football coach. I just don't think he was cut out to be an NFL coach.
Oh, no. You know, the thing is, he tell guys, you know, it was, the job was thrown upon him right away.
Yeah.
He wasn't expecting it, so he wasn't prepared for that job. And I remember the first meeting, he was telling guys that they didn't feel like coming to practice that day. They don't feel like practice. Stay home.
Really?
Two and a half of the defense stayed home.
Well, how the hell did y'all win four games each year?
Hey, 2 years, 4-12, buddy.
Yeah. And the one thing I did see, 1979 or 78, which year was it? I think it was 78 or 78, where you basically, you won three of the last four games. Or no, that was 1980, I think. 80. You get Forrest Gregg in there. Won three of the last four games. You lost the game where Tom Darden took the shot on Pat McAnally, but you ran for 100 yards in three of those four games. I would think the way that you ran the ball was perfect for the way Forrest Gregg wanted his running back to run the ball.
Oh, yeah, it was. You know, Forrest, you know, he was a big Pete Johnson guy. He didn't care what I weighed, and he wanted me to just be you, and that's what I did. Now, I guess something you don't remember. Archie, rookie year, he led the team in rushing and scoring.
Yeah. He led the next seven years, though.
Every year I was there, but then I came the next year. And see, Archie didn't know how to tell them to go screw themselves. So I knew how to tell them, hey, go, you know, F off.
Yeah.
You know, because they you get on that weight thing. Now, so I'm going to ask you a question. The Deacon Turner, TD, Charles Alexander, do they all weigh what you want them to weigh? Oh, yeah, every time. I said, well, how come I'm the only one start? I said, y'all can take it and shove it. Or just trade me.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to do my, I was taught to always do my best no matter what I'm doing. And then you'll have no regrets. So I'm going to give everything I have every play. So I know when no one else is going to come in and take my job.
Yeah, and I mean, Paul Brown was huge on the big fullbacks, whether it was Jim Brown, Merriam, Motley.
Yeah.
I mean, he had guys like that all the time. Even after you had Larry Kennebrew, who Sam Weiss screwed with, I think, and kind of killed that. But when we look going into 1981, the way 1980 ended, did you guys have a feeling that you had something special going?
Oh, we do it. And when we got Chris Collinsworth and – you know, we already had got Anthony Munoz, and then we got Max Montoya, Dan Ross, and we had a bunch of guy of Texas, you know, Don Bass. We had some great young players come in, and oh, it was awesome with all the veteran we had. We knew things were going to happen. And then we changed the uniforms, and that really did it.
Yeah. So what was your first take when you saw those uniforms?
Didn't bother me none, but I laughed at Chris. Chris Collinsworth, he said, man, these things are the ugliest thing I ever seen.
Yeah, but see, it's always good when you change the uniform to immediately go to the Super Bowl because then everybody loves it.
He said, man, we're going to have to put up a shut up ugly as these things are.
And people don't realize how fast and how good Collinsworth was. I know his career was a little shortened because of injuries, but I think he was the rookie of the year in 1981. And I know everybody wants to bitch about him on the TV, but.
I thought he was going to break his leg when he running, but he'd be moving.
Well, I remember, didn't he race a horse or something at the old Latonia racetrack over here?
I heard he did.
He got his ass smoked, though, I think.
Well, yeah, but Chris, whoa, what a great player.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you talk about a veteran, really good offensive line. You had Anthony Munoz in 1980. You already got Mike Wilson. It was Blair Bush back then.
Oh, they really pissed me off when they got rid of Blair Bush.
They did.
Hey, he was such a great center. He was small, but he had technique. And at that position, size don't really matter. Technique. And, man, that Blair could open some holes.
Yeah, because I remember they let Blair go because they drafted Dave Remington, who was a great college player.
I would have took Blair with him 100 times and still with today.
Yeah, because if I remember right, Remington had those little T-Rex arms. He couldn't really reach anybody. He ended up just playing a few years.
It was terrible. Hurt my game.
Yeah, and you had Dave Lappin, Bengals radio announcer.
Big Dave.
And I know I've talked to him about you before, and he said all you knew is if Pete was getting the ball, you better get your ass up the field and get your guy blocked or he's going to be running up your ass.
That's right. And I did it on pay. You know why I did that? When I first came to the Bengals, Boobie Clark was there. And, you know, you fall in love with players.
Yeah.
The coaches love Boobie. The player didn't want me to take his job. So in practice, you know, I'm no dummy. I know when you're blocking for one player and not blocking for the other, when Kenny's throwing the ball harder to me than the Boobie, I know this. So Woody had told me, he said, you know what you do? He said, you just run them over. Stick your head in the middle of their back. They'll start blocking for you. So I did. They, man, open your eyes and run. I said, hey, they was open, and I hit just where I aimed it, and next time it's going to be harder. Kenny throw the ball at me hard. I throw it right back to him and hit him in the chest with it. Hey, mister, that's our quarterback. You can't be doing that. Hey, I'm not on this team yet. So, you know, they thought I was crazy anyway, so it didn't matter.
So, and I think guys that are at training camp today are people to watch Hard Knocks. What training camp? That's exactly what I was thinking. Tell them what a Forrest Gregg training camp was like.
Oh, my God. Grass is in the morning. Grass is in the evening. Grass is at supper time. It was crazy. I thought you work your butt off when you do this. It was, you know, ups and downs. You know, twice a day you're hitting both morning and evening. you got meeting at 7 o'clock. I'm like, you get out an hour before time to bet curfew. It was awesome.
Yeah, I remember going to, where was it back in Wilmington?
Wilmington.
I remember Wilmington. I can't remember. It might have been 1982, the first practice that there you guys ran pads. He lined up in goal line, and they ran goal line for like a half an hour. So,
you know it. Yep.
You don't see goal line anymore anywhere. But the 1981.
You hit in practice anymore. What are you talking about?
You can't hit in practice. Everybody will get hurt. But, and you can only tackle the way it's going right now, you'll only be able to tackle somebody in the chest pretty soon. So, what the hell are you going to do? So, 1981 starts off Seattle Seahawks, which is a team the Bengals should beat, down 21-0 right away. Turk Schoner comes in, leads the team back. But the game that really stuck out to me where I thought this team may be able to do something was the game in New York against the Jets where you guys beat a really good Jets team 34-33. So what's your recollections of the start of that season?
You know, really, I saved my brain cells. I don't think back that far. But, you know, no matter what game or what we playing, I always did my best.
Well, how about you this? Know, I got a game I bet you remember. The 1981 AFC Championship game.
Oh, I ain't never been that cold in my life. That's why I come to Florida every year in the wintertime. That was cold. I remember, hey, we won the game, but I never forget how cold I was.
Well, see, I remember I interviewed Ed White, who played for the Chargers back then in 81. He was a Pro Bowl guard. And we're on the show, and this was like 6-7 years ago, and he starts this crap. Well, if we'd have been playing in San Diego where it was 80 degrees, I go, wait a second. It was 80 degrees when you played in San Diego in November, and the Bengals beat you worse in nice weather. I think it was like 48-17. Yeah. Then they beat you in the AFC Championship game. But the thing that really stood out to me was watching Dan Fouts try to throw the ball compared to Ken Anderson. Kenny looked like it was 80 degrees out. There was no issues. You know, Dan Ross is catching, making fingertip catches, while this great Charger offense of Kellen Winslow, all these dudes, Dan Fouts, end up in the Hall of Fame, which, I mean, to me, Kenny Anderson was greater than Dan Fouts. But another guy I would like you to talk about that was on your offense, because he's a guy that I think gets overlooked way too much, was the tight end on that team, Dan Ross, who for four or five years was as good as anybody that's ever played the position.
He chose in the Super Bowl, too.
Yeah,
Dan was a great, he could block, he could catch the ball. You know, he was just a great, great guy.
Yeah, and what do you remember leading up to that Super Bowl, the 2 weeks headed in?
Oh, just, you know, Forrest didn't want us to get too hyped up too much and, you know, paid a lot of attention to detail. And, it, the player was probably more united than all year, if that was possible, because we were a close-knit group back then.
Yeah. Well, that's the one thing I've noticed about the 81 and the 88 Bengal teams. It seems like most of those guys are still really close, and most of those guys still live in the Cincinnati area.
Mm-hmm. And we still stay in touch.
Yeah. And, I mean, that is a direct reflection of your head coach, I think.
Oh, well, Forrest, you know, I just love Forrest. You know, his wife, we still communicate sometime on Facebook and stuff, and just awesome.
Yeah, and anytime Vince Lombardi says you're the greatest football player he ever coached, you were a pretty damn good football player.
I'm telling you.
Yeah. The Super Bowl 16 still bothers me to this day. I was 13. But all I remember is we turned the ball over like five times to their one. Amos Lawrence fumbles the kickoff return. We get the ball right away inside the 15, throw an interception, get stopped. But the other thing was the onside or the kicks on the ground all the way down, which I think cost us 6 points at the end of the first half. That game, the Bengals were the better team. I mean, they just, for some reason, it looked like the Bengals played tighter than the 49ers did.
I think we're the better team in both games, but that 89, I thought was the best Super Bowl I ever seen.
Oh, that was a great football game.
Yeah, and what the one kid that returned the punt?
Stanford Jennings.
Oh, my goodness, they returned that punt. I was going crazy. Yeah. I was jumping up and down.
Then Jim Breach makes the field goal. There's 3:02 left. I'm celebrating. My dad looked at me. He says, son, they got Joe Montana. We're in trouble.
Yeah, but that was a great game. But, you know, back then, football was a little different than now. I'm not, that was blood on the uniform every play. And, buddy, every team was good. When you make it there, and like now, you know, this past weekend, you look at team. Man, you make it this far, you're good.
Yeah, and the thing is this, though. I think today we see more mediocrity than anything else. I mean, I don't think any team that's in the Super Bowl is a great team. And I think a lot of that comes from
being there.
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes from the softening of the game, because people will say, well, the guys today were too big, too strong, too fast. But I think this, I think the coaching now is horrible compared to what it used to be. I couldn't name you five guys that I think are really good head football coaches in the NFL. And I think technique-wise, with offensive linemen, all the air raid you see in high school and colleges, which basically you don't have to teach them how to kick step, just kills teaching offensive linemen.
Oh, yeah. All they do is grab, twist, and turn.
Yeah.
Not firing out the ball. Sometimes you got to fire. Then you watch the team that do have a great running game, you'll see the guy firing off the ball.
Yeah. And the 49ers are a perfect example with Christian McCaffrey running the ball.
Oh, what a great player. Oh.
Yeah. And you've got, you know, Trent Williams, who's one of the best tackles probably ever played the game. But there's no team
Anthony Munoz.
No, Anthony Munoz was the greatest tackle to ever play the game. Trent Williams is like top 10 or 15. There's never been anybody as good as Anthony Munoz in tackle, I don't think. But so who are some guys that you lined up against? I mean, let's talk about the Pittsburgh Steelers. Because in the 1980s, the Bengals beat them almost every damn time. That's what me and Joe Kelly, we always said, because we used to do shows with Leon Searcy, the old Steeler. Mm-hmm. And Joe said, don't be talking about you owning us. He said, in the 80s, I think you beat us twice. So, and the Bengals had some great teams in the 80s. And
well, remember the 2-4-12 team season? Two of those went against the Steelers, and they was a champ.
Oh, yeah. That was 1980. We beat them twice when we went 6-10 on last-second field goals. The 79 game was my favorite, because that's the one where they turned the ball over like eight times, and we beat them like 34-9 or something. It was something stupid. They still won the Super Bowl, their fans still tell me.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. But, hey, we chat that booty up.
Yeah, and in 1981, that's how you clinched the division, was going to Pittsburgh, winning in Pittsburgh 17-10. 1982, what happened, Pete? I thought that was going to be the year. The team was coming back intact. And then Freeman McNeil happened in the playoffs.
What happened now?
I said, and then Freeman McNeil happened to go off for 202 yards in the playoffs.
Oh,
Bengals
yeah.
Bengals lose 44-17. I was sure we were going to win that game, and we had the lead early. Everything looked good. It just kind of fell apart.
Football. That's what it is, football.
And I can tell you this. I've probably got the autograph in here somewhere. But in 1982, after that playoff game, I remember the Cincinnati Bengals had a traveling basketball team. I think you were on the team, correct?
Oh, yeah.
With Anthony Munoz and them, and you guys played at South Dearborn High School. And I remember going to watch that, and everybody signed everything after. And Anthony Munoz and yourself, y'all could play some basketball.
Oh, yeah. That was my number one sport, was basketball.
Yeah, I said I had forgotten all about that, and it just popped in my head when you talked about playing basketball before. I'm like, damn, I saw him play basketball. Because I still think I got the hand scribble of your name in here somewhere in the room. But so it's weird how stuff happens. So, but what are you doing nowadays? I know you're in Daytona Beach because you've become soft like today's NFL and have decided you need to be in the heat in the winter.
I'm still tougher than they are. I'm in pain 24/7. I still move around. Yeah, we come down for the winter, my wife and I. And, you know, when you retire, you do whatever you want to do.
Yes, you do.
It's been a little chilly down here, though. We ain't been able to go to the beach like we used to. And
What's the temperature today, Joe?
Today going to be 74.
Yeah, Pete, don't complain. It's like 50 here, but it's pouring down rain.
Yesterday was 60.
Well, that's still, we haven't seen, we don't see anything above 50 unless a torrential downpour comes with it anymore. All right, Pete, it was great having you on the show. You're one of my all-time favorite Bengals. You need to be in that Ring of Honor real soon, too, is all I got to say.
Hey, that's all right. I still get over 1,000 letters a month from the fans, and they appreciate me, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, and you were better than you were a lot better than Boobie. But you have to give the fans a break, because I remember going to Bengal games back then and everybody would chant Boobie, Boobie. So I mean, who doesn't like to chant?
Oh no, you just had Pete, Pete, Pete when I played.
I like the Pete too, but I like Boobies better than Pete.
I hope your wife is listening.
Oh, it's all right, because I only like hers. I only like hers, Pete. I know how to do this. All right, Pete, it was great having you on the show. We'd love to have you back on sometime.
All righty. Go back.
All right, guys. That was Pete Johnson. Make sure you check out BetMGM for all your sports betting needs for the Super Bowl. Make sure you follow us on Twitter, or X as they call it now, at Grueling Truth. But for now, I'm Mike Goodpaster. You've been watching and listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak. What'd you think, Pete? That all right?
That's all right. Yeah. How long you been doing this?
I started doing it like 7 years ago, just for the hell of it. And I started a website for the hell of it. And I wrote an article about how Roger Craig, and a separate article about how Tom Flores should both be in the Hall of Fame. And Tom Flores had a guy named Joe Ortiz, who was his publicist. And he calls me and he says, "Hey, you want to interview Tom?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, he's never done an interview with anybody about his past, but he's willing to do it with you." So I did it with him. Next thing you know, Roger Craig's sister calls me. And she's like, "Would you want to interview Roger?" So, hell, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I interviewed both of them. And since basically I'm at a point where I just coach football in the fall now because I coach a high school team, I got nothing else to do. So I figured I would do this. And then a few years ago, somebody came, bought the website. They pay me to basically just be the managing content editor. Mm-hmm. I do these shows, but hell, it's a good time. I make a little bit of money and I get to hang out with my heroes, because I loved Pete Johnson. Pete Johnson and Kenny Anderson were my two favorite Bengals.
Oh, yeah. You know, with Kenny, every year I was there, I came in first in rushing and scoring. You know who came in second? Kenny Anderson.
Kenny, yeah. He was second the Super Bowl year. I think he ran for like 300 or 400 yards.
Yeah.
And I can tell you this also. I mean, when I first met him, first interviewed him, the good thing is he's a really good guy.
He is. Still is.
Yeah, because I know that I do a fundraiser for my high school football team every year, and he found out about it after I interviewed him. The next thing you know, he sent us an autographed jersey to put in a raffle or put in the auction for everything. So that was not even asking for it. And then the next year, he texted me, "You guys doing that again?" I said, "Yeah." He sent another jersey. So
awesome.
But hey, Pete, it was great.
All right, brother.
And I will, we'll stay in touch. We'll do this every once in a while if you want.
All righty.
All right. See you, Pete.
All right, brother. Take care.
Yep. See ya.